Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the early United States form a unique national identity? Eager as many patriots had been to unlock the shackles of British political rule, once they gained their independence, they found they still had very tight cultural and economic ties to their former colonial masters, and they continued to see European and especially British culture as the pinnacle of good taste and refinement. As my guest today will explain, it took decades to replace that perception with true pride in uniquely American culture, and it had devastating repercussions for Americans who were not of European descent. Carrie Ann Akemi-Yokota is a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles. Her new book is called Unbecoming British: How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. Carrie Ann, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You start the book with a description of the furnishings at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, which serve as a sort of metaphor for the state of early America's sense of itself and its place in the world. Tell us a little bit about what could be found there.
Well, Thomas Jefferson really designed his residence to be a national museum, and he had hundreds of visitors come to see the interior and exterior of Monticello. So I use that to open the book because he has this beautiful mixture of refined imported goods from Europe and natural products, which he thought represented the New World. And among these natural products were mammoth bones and, what I find most interesting, Native American artifacts, which he and other Americans considered part of nature.
How consciously did Jefferson and his contemporaries try to forge a uniquely American identity in those early years after independence? Were they thinking about this?
Yes, for me, it was one of their major concerns. So there really was a tension between trying to prove to the rest of the world that they were indeed equal to Europeans, but also trying to say, well, there are some things about America that is unique. Now, the thing that was most interesting to non-Americans, to European thinkers, was the fact that Native Americans, African Americans, and animals, nature, were all part of this New World scene. So the founders were really living in the wild.
What's so fascinating about that is that there was a sort of flow of information and learning that worked this way, that American naturalists and botanists were learning these amazing things, and then they would send their findings back across the Atlantic for official classification.
Yeah, I love it. And in the book, what I do is, and this helps me think about all of these different movements of ideas, people, and objects. I think of Americans as trading the raw for the cooked. Mm-hmm. And so what they would do in terms of the natural resources or natural botanical sources that you talk about, they would gather things. And I love, there are so many stories of Americans climbing and clambering through the wilderness, climbing trees, raiding birds' nests, pulling up plants by their roots and mailing it back to be what I call cooked in the scientific centers of Europe. So they send these natural specimen back to the mother country, and you have great thinkers at the Royal Society, in the University of Edinburgh, trying to make theories, scientific theories, from these natural products. And then they put them in books, they publish the books, which then get sent back to the Americans. So I think it's interesting to see how these circulations of objects turn into ideas that are then re-imported into America.
So for a while, you needed sort of official sanction from across the pond to really have claim over a certain flower or bird or something.
Absolutely. And there's so many heartbreaking stories of Americans who dedicate their lives out in the wilderness, who just want some form of credit for their findings. And unfortunately for them, if they didn't have the proper training or the proper, for instance, the mastery of Latin, they would not get any recognition at all. For them, they really always try. There is also, I should stop and say, there's a hierarchy of knowledge that's in place at this time. And those who create theories are seen to be at the pinnacle of intellectual society. And those who are gatherers are seen as being a bit lesser as intellectuals. So Americans always try to create theories of their own. They send this back along with the specimen, and I found one letter where a member of the Royal Society saying, you know, it's really interesting that you write all of these theories, but please spend more of your time outside gathering things and leave the theorizing to us.
And they also believed in Europe that any European specimen, whether it be plant or animal, would sort of degrade once it took hold in the New World.
Yeah, well, that Buffon was a French thinker who had this idea of the degeneracy of animal species when they are in the New World environment. And people like Thomas Jefferson really did devote plenty of time and money to trying to disprove this. And you, again, have wonderful stories of Americans at a dinner in France, including Benjamin Franklin, and they started fighting about this theory, and the Americans were asked to stand up so they could actually see who was the taller of the two, the French and the Americans. But my favorite story about this theory of degeneracy was the one of the moose, and maybe that's the one that I can tell now. So what Jefferson did was he sent off, he knew that Buffon and other French and British thinkers, European thinkers in general, believed that anything in America was smaller. Mm-hmm. And so he went in search of the world's biggest moose, and he had a lot of military personnel out there in the wilderness trying to find the biggest moose. And to his chagrin, they found a huge moose who had tiny antlers. And these men had no idea why they were. They just thought this was the strangest order that they've ever received. But they were out there. They didn't know about the laws of scientific proof, so they decided to cut off. They said, well, the antlers are going to be very disappointing. So they cut off antlers from another animal, and they included that in the bloody package. And they said, well, you could just fix these on to the moose carcass, or the moose skeleton afterwards. So it didn't work out quite like the founders had hoped.
The other really amazing thing, Carrie-Anne, is that you have this entire new continent. Of course, it had been there, mm-hmm. and there had been people there, but, right. but new to Europeans. But the centers of cartography also remained in Europe.
Yes, so the American cartography business industry really doesn't even start to take off till the 1840s. And what I find interesting, if we're going to go back to that metaphor of the raw for the cooked, you have American colonists, so white Americans, who are serving as the eyes and ears of the British Empire. So they, again, trample through the wilderness, just like your naturalists, and they are gathering cartographic knowledge. They're surveying the land for the on behalf of the British Empire. And the most famous cartographer, or the most famous surveyor, I should say, was our own George Washington, who gets his start in life by being a surveyor. And so you have Americans who send off cartographic knowledge to London, and they are, again, cooked into maps, which are then sold back to the Americans. And in the book, I have a chapter on cartography, because maps are just lovely tools, political tools. And we often think of maps as being a quintessentially objective document, but in fact, they are used. They are used by different sides in different ways. So they are political documents rather than just reflections of truth.
Let's talk about culture, because initially, new Americans, if they were reading in English, they were typically reading English literature.
Well, you know, there was this great debate in the years following the American Revolution. Americans said, well, if France has the French language and England has English, perhaps America should have a language of its own. And you have very, very interesting ideas as to how to go about doing that. The most famous participant in that debate, I would say, was Noah Webster of the famed Webster's Dictionary. And he had some very quite radical ideas about using symbols, which were more efficient and therefore a reflection of a more efficient people. So the debate goes on back and forth until somebody says, and this was a very unfortunate, it was a European observer, says, actually, America does have a native language, that is the language of natives, mm-hmm. the Indians. And when the white Americans heard this, they recoiled at that idea. And really, you hear people going from these radical ideas of a new language to then saying that we're just going to take the extra U out of words like labor. And so it goes from being radical to very, very minor. And I think part of that impulse was also America's need to try to stay connected to the traditions of British literature. And they said, well, you know, Shakespeare or Addison, they are just as much a part of our heritage as they are a part of English heritage. So why would we break that connection? So there are two sides to that coin of wanting to be different and separate, but also wanting to be equal and connected.
Why do you think cultural change took so much longer than change in politics? Because, you know, by the early 19th century, we were sort of well established as this democracy. But it took longer to change the way we thought about things.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating. I would really identify myself as a cultural historian, though I also look at political history and environmental history, et cetera, et cetera. I really think that culture has a different timeline. So one thing that I always do in the classroom is I have my students draw timelines. It seems very elementary, but you know, you have a political timeline that is chock full of events such as the beginnings of war, the end of war with a peace treaty. And culture, though, it does not move in that same direction. So one place that you can find this is, for instance, in cookbooks or children's books, where you have what I call a political lag time. And for years, Americans are using the same, they're eating the same things, they're reading the same things, they are being entertained in the same ways as they used to. So not everything can change at the same pace. And you see a contrast in the French Revolution, where they really do try to enact a cultural break, a cultural shift with, for instance, the adoption of a new calendar. But Americans weren't interested in that. They in fact, try to keep their British culture and to continue to lay claim to this British heritage.
I guess part of that, too, though, is that if you look at the French, it was culture in part that they were rebelling against,
right.
Whereas the American colonists, they didn't have a problem with British culture. They didn't want to be taxed and not represented.
I love how you put that, Chris. That's exactly right. I think for the Americans, I also think we forget that they are fighting for the rights of Englishmen. Mm-hmm. And what is often surprising to readers is that the American Revolution breaks out at the moment, which is the height of Anglicization. So the American colonies had never been more Anglophilic than in the eve of revolution.
How did British tradition affect what was actually taught to children in this country? Were textbooks all British?
Oh, you know, I was just thinking about that. You know, the children's books or the textbooks that Americans used were imported, and even when American publishers, for instance, Philadelphia was a center of American publishing, I found books that were published well into the 19th century in Philadelphia that still said K is for king, and we should revere the king. Q is for queen, and here's a picture of the Royal Mail truck. You know, it was a very interesting experience for me to see that lag time. And if another experiment that I give to my students, I said, well, you know, as historians, we are dependent on extant records. But if you could dream of your perfect record, what would it be? And for me, what I'd love to see is a diary of a school teacher saying, you know, I had to teach today the class not to believe what they read in our textbooks.
Carrie Ann Akemi-Yokota is my guest. She is a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles, and her new book is called Unbecoming British: How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Carrie-Anne Akemi-Yokota. She is a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles and author of the new book Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. Carrie-Anne, I want to talk about higher-level education because the U.S. did have universities by this time. There was Harvard and Princeton and Yale, where, of course, you have taught. But Americans still went to Europe for certain kinds of higher-level education. What sorts of training could they get there that were not yet readily available at American universities?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Theoretical knowledge was much more advanced in Europe, but I specifically was interested in medical training in the book because all of the American doctors that were the leaders of the medical profession here all had to go to the University of Edinburgh, which was the premier medical institution at the time. And what I thought was interesting, I found so many letters from these doctors who said, you know, my patients don't trust my Penn degree. At the time, the University of Pennsylvania had the most well-established medical training program. And they said, you know, if you want to be somebody, you have to go abroad. And the same was true of American artists, writers. That experience of going overseas really did help them to gain prominence when they returned home.
How did the American sense of cultural and intellectual inferiority contribute to the special value placed on whiteness in this country?
Well, in the book, what I argue is that Americans were dependent on imports for refined goods. And the one thing that they did not have to continue to import was whiteness. And so they really hold on to whiteness as the characteristic that differentiated them from people of color. And the way I wanted us to think about the formation of modern American society was thinking about white Americans as being in this triangular relationship between Europe on the one hand and people of color, whether that's African Americans or Native Americans on the other. And going back to your question about the medical field or about overseas education, I think that what's very striking in reading hundreds and hundreds of these letters between American thinkers and their British counterparts is that when the British counterparts say European man is more intelligent or is superior to the rest of the world, Americans will write back and strike out European man and say, yes, the white man is going to be more intelligent than others. So I think that is whiteness was more important to white American settlers than it was in Europe, where whiteness was just a given.
And were people in Europe, did they pay attention to this argument, or did they say, yeah, but you guys are still Americans? You're still, at the time, we were a developing country. I mean, how well did that work?
You mean how well did the Americans trying to, how well did their campaign to change European superiority to whiteness?
Yeah.
Or just, well, I think that for Americans, the struggle really was to be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And again, their proximity to people of color and to the exotic flora and fauna of America really did give them some sort of value in international enlightenment discussions about understanding the world. But again, time and again, Americans felt really isolated. They felt marginalized. They felt as if they were not being respected in the way they thought they deserved.
You write about a particular affinity between Americans and Scots. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that they both felt that Americans and Scots both felt in some ways as if they were peripheral to English culture. And the Scots are often seen as being the stormtroopers of empire. So you had Scots who were much more willing to go far afield in order to increase their own wealth or influence. And so you see many Scots who come to the United States in order to do just that, and also the colonies before America became the United States.
How did this dynamic of British superiority and American inferiority culturally affect the way we looked at East Coast residents as compared with those who struck out and went west in terms of their refinement?
You know what? I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the questions that I often get is, if Americans felt insecure, when does it end? And which in some ways is kind of an insecure question. But I say that you see a shift when people start to move from the East Coast to the Western frontier. And you hear the Western frontiersmen, these are European settlers themselves, saying the same thing, complaining about East Coasters looking down on them in the same way as Philadelphians and New Yorkers say the English look down on them. So you see this replication of cultural hierarchies in the later 19th century.
So although this plays out in different ways in different cultures around the world, whether it's based on class or skin color or faith or whatever, is there something that you've identified as a cultural historian about the human condition that requires a sort of permanent underclass?
I mean, the idealist in me would like to say that there's not, that no.
But yeah, I'm not endorsing this.
I know you're not. I'm just trying to think about that statement, which I think is a great point. I think that what I set out to do when I began this study was really to imagine American society, or go back to a time in history when American society really was at the bottom of a larger international hierarchy, when American founders themselves felt as if they were minor players on a larger world stage, and to understand the change which has occurred between that moment of American, I guess, weakness to the point which America ascends as a world power. And to try to understand, by understanding America in this early period, maybe we can be more sympathetic to newly emerging nations now.
We should talk here a little bit more about stuff, about trade commodities and consumer goods, because you made the point earlier that we would export raw data and have it sort of finished out in Europe. The same thing happened with raw materials, which, of course, explains why Britain was interested in this continent in the first place. There's a great source of raw materials.
Right. My favorite example, which illustrates just what you're saying, is the beaver pelt. Mm-hmm. And what I talk about is the fact that you have Americans on the East Coast reaching out to Native Americans in the Western frontier for beaver pelts, which then get sent back to Philadelphia. They send it to England, where the beaver pelt is turned into felt top hats, which are then imported at a cost back to American elites who use the top hats as one of the many, many symbols of their superiority vis-a-vis both the underclass, as you were saying earlier, and people and Native Americans and African American slaves. So you see that product moving full circle.
So these status symbols that were finished or created whole in Europe must have been available only to people with a great deal of wealth.
Yeah, but, you know, that's true and not true. For instance, I would use a commodity of tea as a good example. In the later years of the 18th century and then the early 19th century, more and more common folk are enjoying imports such as tea. So something that starts off as being just a very, very upper-class, expensive product filters down. And oftentimes, one thing that differentiated American society, and this is recorded especially in travelers' narratives, is that the lower classes in America tend to consume above what the British felt was their station. And you still hear people saying that about American consumption now, that, you know, there were numerous accounts of British travelers who go to the Western frontier in order to just, it was like a tourist attraction to see how white Americans were living in these log cabins or mud huts, as they put it, and you would find a gilt mirror. And they found that very, very interesting, because you would not see a peasant in England with the same kinds of adornments.
So it was simply that the American peasants had something to prove.
Perhaps. Or it's this idea of the democratization of goods, uh-huh. that somehow consuming the same objects as the upper class makes us all much more equal.
I was really interested in the idea that foreign craftsmen started producing goods specifically designed not only to appeal to American patriotism, but to, in fact, create a demand for patriotic goods.
Yeah, I love that. What I found so fascinating was that after the war, Americans were dependent upon English, for instance, English pottery manufacturers to create patriotic goods with anti-British sentiment, messages of anti-British sentiments. And I thought, that's wonderful. So we won the war, and we're now giving our money to Englishmen who are willing to say, you know, down with the tyranny of Britain, and you have George Washington with his boot on the head of the English lion on one jug that I love, that mm-hmm. I put in the book. And I think that's interesting that they really, Americans are looking abroad for these patriotic goods.
But in a way, it was really, for the British, it wasn't so much an admission of defeat as it was a way to make a buck or a pound.
Absolutely, and I don't think that any of these, all, you know, you could think of many reasons why a British merchant or a British manufacturer would make a piece like that. Maybe they were sympathetic to the American cause from the beginning, but I do think when it comes down to it, most of them, it's really what you say, they're trying to make a buck, and they didn't think that creating these objects was in any way going to threaten British superiority.
So Americans took great pride when they would have visitors from overseas and showing off all their European finery. Certainly they showed it off to their neighbors. But there was a reputation in Europe of the fact that they were sort of giggling behind their hands and sending over only the lowest quality exports.
Yeah, and again, I have such great sympathy for these early Americans who really were bending over backwards to show off to these British visitors. And what I found was that Americans were always trying to keep up with British fashion, but it was like being on a treadmill. You're running, but you could never catch up. They were always, there was always a lag time. And then, as you mentioned, the British traders or merchants were always sending their inferior quality goods to America or out-of-date goods that they could no longer sell in London. And for Americans who thought that they were embracing these goods, which were at the height of English fashion, to be told by a visitor that, oh dear, that tea set is so quaint. My grandmother used to use that. It was really devastating.
Yeah, it must have been upsetting for them to, on the one hand, this was a symbiotic trade relationship. The British needed us mm-hmm. exactly as much as we needed them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we were really separated geographically from all these European centers of refinement. So it wasn't entirely our fault that we couldn't keep up.
No, not at all. And we have information that's just, we can't keep up with how instantaneous this is. There, you know, you're looking at Americans who are reading newspapers that are several weeks old. And so, no, it wasn't their fault at all. And I think that, you know, I feel like one of the things that I wanted to talk about was when I say, when does this end? Americans really do begin to forge a separate culture when they decide that it's no use to try to be at the forefront of English fashion. Now, they still go to England for their goods, but instead of trying to get the latest, for instance, China designs or patterns, they decide to get something that's more simple.
Hmm.
And so you're never at the height of fashion, but you can't be laughed at for missing the mark if you just have a very plain and simple pattern. Now that gets translated later into this idea that American tastes are democratic, more simple, more Republican.
So we just recast this practical consideration as something that we chose to do.
Absolutely. Huh. You're beautifully said. So often when I read, for instance, museum guides or catalogs, they'll say this is an example of American democracy or Republican, simple Republican tastes. And I think, no, it's actually what this book captures is the moment that kind of in between, the uneasy, tense moment when we don't know which way to go.
Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phone now to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, how are you? I wonder if your guest drew from much of Ben Franklin. I remember reading in his autobiography that once it was learned how much the British had studied the American Revolution and gone out of their way to sabotage everything that we had ever done, the Americans essentially decided to boycott everything that was British. And I wonder if she's derived much of that from her book.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, David. I think Franklin is a fascinating figure, and he does figure prominently as well in my research. But I see Franklin, he's so astute in reading the, the political winds or engaging his responses accordingly. And I find that he says both things. On one hand, he says, you know, I am so glad that I no longer want these products. And on the other hand, he's sending many British goods to Deborah back at home with very explicit instructions as to how to use them, lest she embarrass herself in front of British guests or European travelers. So he says both things. He also is very famous for his comments for being very abstemious, and yet he indulges wildly in the best of English and French culture. So I think he has both things, but I don't think that he ever gives up British goods or European goods in his personal life.
I guess no surprise that he's gone down in history as one of America's great statesmen. Obviously, he had political instincts that the likes of which are still seen today.
Right.
My guest this hour is Carrie Ann Akemi-Yokota. She is a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles and author of the new book, Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Carrie Ann Akemi-Yokota, who is a fellow at the Huntington Library in Los Angeles and author of the new book Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. Carrie Ann, how did what was often at the time called the Second War for American Independence, the War of 1812, did that sort of seal the deal for us in realizing we needed to break from Great Britain?
Well, I opened the book with Monticello and a description of that as this a quintessential American home, and I end the book with the burning of the White House during the War of 1812, so yet another American home that is destroyed by the British. And I think that for Americans, like you said, it really did represent a turning point. However, what I wanted readers to be aware of was the fact that well into the mid-19th century, Americans are still worried about Britain being at their borders. For instance, the Oregon conflict in the 40s is a moment of American and British tension where Americans are really, really worried that the British are going to try to take over North America once again. So although the War of 1812 is significant in saying, look, we really do have to break with the British, the specter of this long British shadow does not end completely.
You mentioned earlier Benjamin Franklin sending goods home to his wife, Deborah. I thought it was remarkable that ultimately, as we looked to move away from our dependence on European goods, these were sort of reframed as desires that only women had and therefore things that weren't very important.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because today, at least, people always assume that's women who like to do the shopping. But in this period, in the revolutionary period, it's the men who make the major household purchases. So, for instance, George Washington is the one who is corresponding with merchants overseas to gather these different types of refined goods. And, you know, I guess I should also make the point that in talking about the founders' purchasing habits, I don't think it's something that's just frivolous. I think it had profound political meaning for them because in order to be respected as a nation, as a separate nation, Americans had to have these goods. So it's not to denigrate the founders in any way, but rather to say that they needed these British patrons, these British objects and British ideas in order to create a separate nation.
Let's go back to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Hi. I was wondering if the guest thought that perhaps our conversation was neglecting the influence of the French in post-colonial America. I agree that most of the common, everyday, ordinary goods, manufactured goods, came from England, particularly with the advent of the Industrial Revolution there. But where else were we going to go for those kind of things? There was
right.
no manufacturing in Mexico or Canada. And with that said, it seems to me that the French dominated the they dominated the finer things in life with clothing, fashion, architecture, design, culture in general. I know of no can't think of too many English artists that caught on in America in the 19th century, but there are numerous examples of French artists that captured American imagination.
Great.
What do you think about that, Carrie Ann?
Yeah, no, that's a great comment, Ed. In fact, what Americans who traveled to Europe would find, and they knew this through also their reading and their correspondence, the English did not represent the pinnacle of European society and culture, as Ed is making the point. So I think the French or French goods, it was actually a very elegant response or an elegant solution to the problem of trying to be unbecome British, so to speak. And Jefferson is the most famous Francophile of his generation. He loved French culture, and so he brought a lot of French goods into Monticello. But what I think is interesting, although I do address the influence of French culture in my book, I really did want to interrogate that post-colonial relationship with the mother country. And so I often would see Americans grabbing onto any example of French patronage and using that to actually stick their tongues out at the British to say, look, the French like us. The French think we're interesting. I'm going to get help from the French rather than you. But I still saw that French relationship vis-a-vis this attempt to break from the British.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Amy in Fort Worth. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Amy. Hi. Fine, thank you. I'm really enjoying the program.
Oh, good.
I have a question about entertainment in America. Specifically, y'all were talking about how some writers were sent over back to Europe and England to get their training there. I wondered, specific to music and theater and other forms of live entertainment, how much of that was imported from England, or how much did Americans try to forge their own brand of entertainment?
Great question, Amy. Thanks. Well, I know of many British acting troupes that would come over to America and do tours, and so they'd go on the road. But it was very hard in terms of music and culture to get the kind of training you would get in Europe. So any ambitious American would go over there, but they were not great in numbers. And the other thing, going back to our earlier conversation, when English travelers would meet up with these English acting troupes, they would always say, well, it's the ones that couldn't make it back home that come here to great applause and praise. So again, it's interesting, those who can't make it in the home country often came here to America and became instant celebrities.
It makes me think about professional ball players who can't quite get into the major leagues here, and they play in Europe for a while, and then they hope to come back over.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's so many fun connections that you can make between today and what was going on then, yeah.
You know, it is interesting reading this book to think that there was, obviously this time when it was British cultural hegemony, which was troubling people, and now,
right.
You know, many parts of the world are bothered by American hegemony. Is there reason to believe that what took place in this country will ultimately take place, among the people of China and India and places like that?
I really appreciate that comment, and I've been thinking about why I was so attracted to this perspective of this revolutionary period. I was interested in this moment when Americans were so involved and so connected to what was going on globally. And as Americans became more powerful, they seemed to become less and less interested in the world around them. And that was what Americans said about the British. You know, they care not what we do here. Mm. And it's a symptom of power, but I don't think it actually contributes to one's power, because look what happens. The British are not necessarily aware of the extent to which Americans' unhappiness is going to turn into a revolution until it's much too late. And so the idea that you have to be aware of the what's going on around you, and it's a global society, that's not a new thing. So that's why I feel like this approach to the early republic, to the revolutionary moment, it's a nice time to revisit that with the things that are happening around the world today.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mikhail on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mikhail.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I think the question earlier really relates to my question. The pre-Paris and the Paris eras of Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin with the Sally Hemings story being interwoven into that.
Ah, yes. Well, I wanted to talk or share a story about Sally's brother James, who, along with Sally, goes to Paris with Jefferson. And so Jefferson was told, you know, do you want to bring them over? Because in France, slavery was not legal, so they could have technically run away. He brings them over. He brings Sally's brother James over specifically to be trained in French cookery. And so he sends James to culinary school. He learns the art of French pastry. He brings him, James does agree to go back to Monticello and work for Jefferson. And he impresses all of Jefferson's visitors, both American and European, with his culinary skills. Now, when he asks to be freed, however, his own knowledge keeps him enslaved, because Jefferson says, I need you to impress my European guests. I can't let you go until you train someone else. And in the end, James ends up training his own brother, who stays in Jefferson's service. So I think that's a really interesting twist on this very deep relationship of Jefferson with the Hemings family.
What did British visitors to the United States think about the American sense that they had their fingers on the pulse of British culture?
I think that the British were surprised at how much the Americans thought they knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in the fact that Americans really were obsessed with British culture. And it's funny, you talk about the current day, but my British friends still say that we are more in love with the royal family today than they are. Well,
yeah.
And I always say, well, we get to enjoy the spectacle, but we don't have to pay their bills.
Mm-hmm.
So the British thought this was strange, but they also in some ways took it for granted that everybody would want to know about the most powerful nation on the earth at that moment. Just as many, you know, you can go traveling today, and it's surprising how much people know about American culture. They may get it slightly, we might say, wrong, but they are aware of American pop culture, our entertainment media, things like that.
And I guess we run the risk of taking for granted that means that our culture is superior, as opposed to meaning that it's just everywhere and freely available.
Exactly correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
Do you see signs today of American sort of deference to British culture? I mean, there are still people who walk around and talk about how much they love the British accent, and you don't hear them saying that about other countries necessarily.
No, absolutely. I always am amazed at how Americans, and we also in America, I've lived in Britain when I was doing my research, and I taught there when I had sabbaticals from Yale. We don't know, we think that every British accent is an upper class accent. So even if there's a working class Cockney accent that we hear, we say, oh, Deb, do you know the Queen? And even if in jest. And whenever we have an American, I always say sitcoms are the shorthand for what's going on in American society. Whenever you want a snobbish character, you always have someone with a faux British accent. And sadly for me, they're always a professor, you know, like the kind of Fraser Crane type person. So it's this anti-intellectualism and also this still that we think British culture is synonymous with upper class culture. And it's really not. It's really a mix of things and a mix of classes.
So we've talked about the way that Americans struggle to treat people of color equally, even among immigrants from other places. Do you think this early Anglophilia explains why we have, at various points in our history, including now, struggled with the idea that there is room for people who come from different cultures? And I'm thinking right now, of course, south of the border is something that
right.
we're really struggling with.
Well, and going back to the accent, a French or British accent, but especially British, because you could understand they're speaking English, it can increase your employability. But an Asian accent, a Spanish accent could hurt it. And I think that that's a reflection of this earlier period. And I also think that I wanted to look in the book, at American racism or the origins of American racism. As being a function not of power, but of feelings of powerlessness. And so looking at both sides of the coin, so to speak. And it's not to excuse racism, but it's to really understand that Americans felt, in a lot of ways, they felt that their backs were against the wall. They felt that they were in a position of powerlessness, and therefore racial inequality was something that they turned to.
Well, it really is an instructive perspective to apply to what's taking place in this moment still.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there is this tendency to always look at racism or oppression or just inequality in general as being expressions of someone feeling at the top of the world. And that's why in the book, again, I do not want to denigrate the wonderful achievements of the founders, but rather to understand them in their complexity and in their full humanity.
The new book by Carrie-Anne Akemi-Yokota is called Unbecoming British, How Revolutionary America Became a Post-Colonial Nation. Carrie-Anne, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
I've enjoyed it so much, and thank you for having me on your show. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.